Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings here on Thursday morning, the 4th of October. Glad you're listening as we start our day together. We'll be talking and have been talking about relevant news items, special interest topics with guests from around our country. And as we do so, we'll try to talk about these things not from the Democratic or Republican standpoint or some other partisan point of view, but we'll talk about these things with the real faith and genuine hope that comes as believers in an eternal kingdom that serve the only eternal King, that Jesus Christ. So we will have guests that come on, certainly with different perspectives and different angles for how they talk about these things, but we will stay united in the journey together of faith. I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner. Grateful to be joined in studio by Rachel Sutton, who's on the boards this morning as Logan Rausch is out, and Paul Perreault, who is keeping the news flowing. And of course, you know, if you listen, how much we love to hear from you as listeners when you call and text the studio. And you can do that at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And of course, Thursday mornings is a great time to line up those texts and those phone calls, because it does mean at the 7 o'clock hour here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, I'm joined by Professor of Christian Theology, Jim Bilby, who comes on the program every Thursday. And all questions and all topics are fair game. We really can ask anything of Jim. And Jim, I'd be curious. Good morning, by the way. Glad to see you in studio here this morning.
How's it going, Peter? Glad to be here.
You know, I was talking with Ben Johnson of the Acton Institute in the first hour, and I have to admit that I'm getting a little weary of some of these headlines day in and day out. It feels like the sort of the end of Braveheart. If somebody could just shout mercy and bring this whole thing to a conclusion in Washington, D.C., it feels like it might be the best for all of us.
You know, it's like an avalanche, right? And it just never kind of stops. And you get skeptical and frustrated and angry, and then it still keeps coming. It's tough.
And of course, part of it, that is a really important conversation we need to be having in our culture, has to do with the hashtag MeToo movement, where women have been treated so terribly in a variety of circumstances for a lot of years now. But we're seeing sort of this vengeance kind of mentality coming out of it from certain circles as well. And of course, there is a Georgetown University faculty member, C. Christine Fair, who came out and basically said all white men should die. And then she graphically described the ways in which white men should die and that feminists should laugh over their graves. And she claimed First Amendment rights to be able to say these things. And the administration at Georgetown gave her the coverage to say, yes, she does have First Amendment rights, but we expect her to be free from bias in the classroom. To which, Jim, you've been teaching how many years at university or upper education?
You know, it's 20 now. It's solid 20 years. So, bias-free teaching. Tough, right?
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever run into bias-free teaching, including even in my class. Now, try to have, you know, a weigh the sides and critically think through and really be fair to everything. But we all have our biases, right? This is just political coverage at best.
Yeah, so the concept of teaching, really, or the concept of being bias-free in your teaching, is it's just a non sequitur. It doesn't happen.
Right.
It'd be great. It's a great ideal to shoot for. When I teach, I try to make sure I'm teaching all the ranges of views, and I'm trying to give even views that I don't believe, that I don't accept. I'm trying to give the best possible spin, to give the best possible arguments for them, right? But in the final analysis, you always subtly, in ways that you're not even aware of, bring your own perspective. And so I actually will just tell my students, this is where I'm coming from. So just so you know, and you can kind of factor that in when you're thinking about things. So yeah, I think what this is we expect you to be free of bias is political speak for, you said something really dangerous for us, so we're going to, you know, try to make this go away. It seems to me that's exactly what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's well spotted. It's one of those things at least I try to do in my classroom and say, as you said, here's where I'm coming from. I promise I will never grade you on whether or not you agree or disagree with this statement. You just need to support your point of view. And boy, it'd sure be nice if we'd stop shouting at each other and really begin to think about how we can support these views.
No, for sure. And I think actually probably what they should have said is something more along the lines of not that you're going to be unbiased, but that we expect you to treat every single person in your classroom with dignity and respect. right? And that includes even the white males that perhaps have been guilty as a category of hurtful things and actions that have been certainly not remotely Christ-like and probably not even moral. Yep, you know what? That's the case. But you can't paint with the broad brush of all white men any more than you could paint with a broad brush of all members of any group.
Yeah, as well said, that's Jim Bilby, professor of Christian theology, who joins me on Thursday mornings for our Ask Anything segment. We'll take a short break. If you'd like to call or text the studio, you can at 877-933-2484, and all questions are fair game this morning. And I know when we come back, Jim, I'm going to ask you whether or not Christians should get tattoos. Should be an interesting conversation next on Faith Radio Mornings. Jim, that is my walk-up music historically. You've come in studio. We've been friends for a long time, and you come in and you steal my walk-up music that Bill Arnold gave for me, which was our segment, Nothing from Nothing. Bill claimed that I really had nothing to say, and he was not far from the truth relative to that. You've got to – what is going to be your walk-up music for this segment, Jim?
Well, we got to work on it. But just to be clear, I didn't steal anything. I have no authority here whatsoever.
You don't?
So I just kind of sit here and music happens. So
really?
You know, really?
Okay. So
I don't have any computer that I can hit buttons on right now.
Oh, that's true. That's a pretty good point. That was well spotted and deconstructed my thought there. Well, I would love your take. I know you and I were chatting this week a little bit by text about some topics we could get into, and certainly one that even came up in my class recently, and it comes up pretty often because students increasingly are getting tattoos. Yep. Certainly you and I covered the NBA for quite a number of years, and when we were in the locker rooms with players, I mean, almost all of the NBA players had tattoos. You know, even from head to toe, they had run out of real estate as to where to put them. Certainly, I know people, when they start talking about getting tattoos, it almost becomes this addiction sort of thing. I want more and more. When I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, Jim, somebody who had a tattoo, I mean, they were really on hell's door at that moment.
Clearly,
things have changed. And what do you think about this whole idea about Christians getting tattoos?
Well, and I think the root of the worry about this is a very biblical sort of thing. So Leviticus 19:28, rough paraphrase, you will not mark your body, you will not get tattoos, I am the Lord, or something roughly like that, right? And so how can a Christian, with the Bible that just says something that clearly, that straightforwardly, how can a Christian get a tattoo? Well, the interesting thing is I noticed that your hair length and my hair length, well, especially your hair length, doesn't really meet the requirements in the Old Testament for how men should have their hair. And I'm betting that you are wearing woven of cloth that doesn't meet the Old Testament requirements as well.
This is a silk hoodie, Jim. This is a silk hoodie I'm wearing. It's not a blended polyester.
Well, I stand corrected, Peter. I'm not sure I'd admitted that on the radio if I was you. But there's all these various requirements in the Old Testament. Some of them we take seriously, like you shall not murder and commit incest and bestiality and things like this. Some of them we feel comfortable dismissing. And so we have to do the difficult work of what in the Old Testament Levitical law is for today and what is not. And the question of tattoos, I think it has everything to do with the Canaanites, the religions around the Israelites at the time, as part of their cult, as a part of their religious practices, would mark themselves that would indicate the gods that they worshipped, right? So in that context, where being called out and being separate from the surrounding nations was such an important part for the people of Israel, it was absolutely crucial that Israelites not look like Canaanites. And if they put marks on their body, they would go, oh, you're just a Canaanite. In our context, there's not a lot of Canaanite worshipers around.
Right.
So the putting of tattoos does not have that significance of aligning yourself with some sort of Canaanite god. So I think then that makes it possible. Now, I think it's still, if you have trillions of tattoos and you're spending all sorts of money on these tattoos that you don't have, that's maybe a bad idea, but I think it's possible to choose to have a tattoo and have that be a good choice. And for instance, my my daughter Maddie just got a tattoo, and it's a tattoo of a wave and Philippians 1:6 on there, and it for her it represents a decision on her part to be open to where God is taking her. And actually, as a dad, I couldn't be more proud.
Mm. Well, I remember the first time that I saw some of these tattoos in Christian circles, and it was confusing for me, right? Because tattoos were wrong and bad. And then somebody maybe had, like Maddie does, a Bible verse associated with it. I thought, what am I supposed to do with that? This is scripture now, and yet we're maybe not supposed to. But let's talk a little bit more even about Leviticus that you referenced. How do we understand that book in terms of what are some timeless truths that we should attend to? And what are those things that I think you've rightly identified as don't do these things? Because we need the context that Israel was just coming out of a long period of slavery. They had lost their sense of identity. There wasn't a sense of set apartness yet for the Israelites as they began this journey. And so there were some temporary prohibitions in Leviticus to say, hey, don't get confused here. Don't start. You need to continue to follow and worship this Yahweh God. We need to establish an identity, and therefore don't do the things of the Canaanites. But when there's an established identity, it's maybe a different story. But Jim, how do we tell the difference maybe in books like Leviticus, right, where this was for back then, don't wear this kind of clothing, versus what's established for today?
Well, I wish I could give you all the odd-numbered verses, the verses that are still for today or something like that. But whatever it is, it's not going to be that simple. So first thing we have to do, we have to read Leviticus in context, right? And second, we have to ask the question, what are the things in Leviticus that are still picked up by the New Testament and articulated as for today, right? So, like you said, there are some things in Leviticus that deal with health requirements that make perfectly sense and make perfect sense in that context, but less so in these in this context. But there's no like magical. So, some people have tried to say, well, there's moral requirements and there's the Levitical cultish requirements or the specific practice requirements. And honestly, it's not that easy to divide it up that way. So you have to do the difficult work of asking what are the things that the New Testament picks up and articulates as timeless principles. And certainly there are those things. And as such should be taken very seriously.
Yeah, it sure seems like a consistent witness across scripture really helps us understand what's going on in Leviticus. So you do have these prohibitions in Leviticus, but then Paul will come back and say you can eat food, you know, that is dedicated to idols, or you have other dimensions of that. Because one of the critiques I hear often from my students is saying, well, in these same passages, it says it's an abomination for a male to lie with a male. And so they will say, see, you know, gay relationships is only a temporary prohibition. But if you look at that one across the arc of the text, there isn't any relaxing of that relative to our relationships. I don't know if that's part of how we can process this.
For sure. And what's more, and when Paul is talking, he's doing sin lists in, you know, 1 Corinthians 6:9, 1 Timothy 1:10, I believe. When he's using he creates a word. He literally makes up a word to talk about an action that he believes to be sinful. And what he is he's taking the Septuagint version of the Leviticus passage. The Leviticus passage is you should not lie with a man as one lies with a woman. In Leviticus 18:22, the Greek is meta arsenos koin gynaikos, and he makes a word out of that, arsenikotai.
Yeah.
And literally the word is kind of it's a amalgam of a phrase, you shall not man sex, basically man bed, literally.
Right.
So that is about as clear a connection and a validation of the Leviticus text as you can get.
Well, I love these conversations, Jim. There's so many things we can get into. We got to take a short break. When we come back, I have to ask you whether or not I should be listening to Bono and U2, or if I should only be listening to what's considered Christian music. So I know this question comes up a lot in our church communities in my classroom. So we'll get into that next with Jim Bilby, professor of Christian theology here on Faith Radio Mornings. It's 21 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings and having a fun and insightful conversation with Dr. Jim Bilby, professor of Christian theology, where we really can ask anything. Jim, there is a caller called in with a really important question. It's too big for this morning, but I think we could get into this at another time on a Thursday morning. They asked the question, can you go deeper into the difference of the ceremonial law and the Torah fulfilled in Christ and the moral law, which still applies today? And I think maybe a derivative of that question that I get often is when we read books like Hebrews, for example, Hebrews chapters 8 through 10, there's all this about the atoning sacrifice of Christ and how that is sort of the fulfillment of the sacrificial system in the Old Testament. How do we understand these things? That'd be a great topic at some point in our time together.
Yeah, the atonement is obviously a crucial question for Christianity, and it pulls on so many different things. It's pulling out of the Old Testament. There is a fulfilledness out of the Old Testament material, but there's also rich theological detail that can be articulated from the New Testament as well. And so huge questions, really important question, probably not for today.
Yeah, it's a little too big for this morning, yeah. But we can definitely address that another time. So thanks for that call. I know in our remaining time that one of the topics that would be, I think, worth discussing this morning comes up often in my class, and that is whether or not we should be listening to or appreciating secular music. I know just even last week, my family and I, we went and saw Hamilton, and I'll get texts and emails that are, yeah, wonderful, Hamilton was this great performance, and other people will say you should never, ever go even, near the theater where Hamilton is. You should never turn on the radio to anything other than Christian music. And some people say we're really grateful. Help me walk through this, Jim. I mean, there's no verse in Ephesians 27 that says thou shalt not listen to secular music. So how do we think about this?
Yeah, so it's a tough one, right? Because I think you can throw the net even broader. So as you did with the theater, right? So if something is done by a non-Christian person, is it inherently suspect or problematic?
That's the question.
Right? Yep. That's the question, right? And I think you're really hard pressed to say that just because a non-Christian person does something that it's inherently suspect, right? Let's say there's a song and it's just guitar and it's played by composed by a non-Christian, and they're playing just guitar and it's just beautiful guitar music. And you love guitar, but this is clearly a non-Christian playing this. So I have a hard time understanding. Guitar music itself doesn't have a moral valence, doesn't have a spiritual disposition, right? And so I think the concept that just because a secular person does that, that makes it a bad thing. What would make something a good thing or a bad thing, or whether it points you to Christ, or whether it points you in a direction that you know you shouldn't go, right? So the decisions that I make in terms of music are, does this ultimately bring me joy in a Christ-like sense, or does it fill the worst parts of my personality, maybe the anger or whatever it would be, does it fuel that in ways that I need to be asking myself, does this actually going to help me in my walk with Jesus Christ? So I think secular music, I actually listen to a lot of secular music and I really, really enjoy it. And what I find in secular music is beauty and power and transcendent things that actually in a certain sense point me back to God, even if the purposes or the goals or the thoughts of that secular artist aren't remotely Christian. Mm-hmm. So if I think of some powerful rock and roll song that has just this amazing power and speed and brilliance of musical ability, that actually, when I hear that, even though these guys are, again, not remotely Christian, that the power of that points me back to God. So that's, for me, a crucial piece of this.
Yeah, and I think if we're honest with ourselves, our conscience can kind of help guide that process a little bit. I mean, we don't want to, I get it, you can be misled by your conscience, but yeah. What you're suggesting is that sometimes when I move to tears by just powerful music or powerful art, that I'm not thinking in that moment whether that music or that art came from a believer for sure. I mean, I think about the end of Les Miserables when I am just reduced down to a weeping mess. I don't know if Victor Hugo was a believer, but there was something within all of that that really pulled on the strings of heaven.
Yeah, no question. There's these things, and Christians could put this under the category of common grace, that humans still have the capacity and, you know, by virtue of the image of God in us, by virtue of being created by God, we have this capacity to point to these transcendent things of beauty, of power, of love, sacrifice, and all these fundamental transcendent ideas, while I think most purely and clearly articulated in the person of Jesus Christ, and therefore Christians who have a good understanding of who Jesus is have a better picture on what that is, you can still be a non-Christian and articulate these powerful notions in ways that can be edifying for Christians. The key is we need to be intentional and thoughtful about what we're listening to and why we're listening to it, and then check ourselves. Okay, why? What is the purpose? Is there something here that's inappropriate? Is there something here that's not helpful? And when you do that, I think certainly that these sorts of things are open to us.
That's great wisdom from Jim Bilby. Jim, we started our segment with the idea that you needed to come up with some music. Speaking of music for your walk-in segment, you have stolen mine unceremoniously that I used to do with Bill Arnold, and nothing from nothing gets nothing. Clearly, this segment is more than nothing, way better than anything I ever brought to the table with Bill. So your job next time, and I'll be waiting with bated breath, is to give us that walk-up music of choice. Thanks for joining me here on Faith Radio Mornings.
Happy to be here, Peter.
We'll take a break here for Breakpoint and bottom of the hour news. And when we come back for the second half of this hour, I'll be joined by one of your favorites, Kim Cotola, and we'll talk a lot about the issues of life in our country and so much of what's happening with the Supreme Court confirmation process. So lots more to come here on Faith Radio Mornings. Some headlines coming out of Ireland. I'm going to have to ask Dr. David Aikman about next Monday on the show. It says that officials in Ireland think a drone delivered Chinese takeout to inmates. Irish prison officials believe a drone was used to deliver Chinese food at the Wheatfield Jail in Dublin. They say they found containers of fast food in a bin in the yard of the jail. The official said there's no other conceivable way that Chinese food could have gotten there other than by a drone. They said it only shows that inmates will go to great lengths to get what they want, even if it's Kung Pao chicken. I can't wait to ask Dr. David Aikman about that next week here on Faith Radio Mornings. And I see that Kim Cotola will be joining us next, and we'll be talking a bit about issues of life in our country and what a serious and important conversation that is. So lots more to come here this morning. Stay with us on Faith Radio Mornings. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, I was joined by Professor Karen Swallow Pryor, who teaches at Liberty University in the English department. And we are talking about the hashtag MeToo movement that she's a part of with the Southern Baptist Convention. And she was referencing this idea that boys need to be taught early how to behave and respect women.
The boys need to be taught as well. They need to be taught what it means to respect women and what they is completely off limits to do. I personally know someone some light has been shed on his activities in the past, and he insists that he has never harassed women. And I think that some men, many men don't even know some of the behaviors they engage in, and they don't realize that that actually is harassment. So these are the kinds of things that we have to talk about, so that we're all at least understanding things from a similar perspective, because sometimes men think that they're just being playful, or boys will be boys, and that is not how it is received at all.
It's a great conversation with Karen yesterday. I know that around our dinner table last night, we were talking about these very things based on what she was saying. So if you're part of a family or a grandparent, parent, anything along those lines, you can listen to that segment yesterday. Karen had some really important things to say about how we can raise young boys and young girls relative to this new reality of hashtag MeToo in our culture. So you can catch that entire segment at myfaithradio.com. Well, I see Kim Cotola is already on the line. You know her voice well. She's been part of these shows for many years here on Faith Radio, and we're going to talk a lot about different dimensions of life and pro-life in our country coming up next.
With 6.1 trillion texts sent over the past year, our teens know how to communicate. But still, our teens are desperate for something more. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Our teens are desperate for connection. The need for relationships, for community, for a place of belonging drives our teens. But since they haven't learned to make connections other than the internet or text messages, they go to extremes to bond with others. Your teen needs to be taught what it means to connect. Don't take the extreme approach by banning cell phones and Facebook. Instead, take a night to shut off all screens and connect with your family. Show your teenager that relationships aren't formed by texting on a phone. Look them in the eye and connect.
Want to bring Mark to your church or community? Find out how to request an event in your area when you visit ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Peter Kapsner, and delighted to be joined on the line by Kim Cotola of Cradle My Heart Ministries. Kim, good morning. It's great to have you on the program.
Good morning, Peter.
So, you know, you often and obviously talk at length about issues of life in our country, and to have just on at this point, it seems like a really relevant time given so much of what's happening in the Supreme Court confirmation process, where I know a lot of the energy about whether Kavanaugh gets confirmed or is not confirmed is really around the issue of Roe versus Wade. How are you thinking about this? How are you walking through the situation?
Well, it's important for us to keep whatever is unfolding, as disconcerting as it may be, in a larger context. And to know that the people opposing Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation at this point have been opposing him before any of these current allegations came forward and before anything was known about his character in the, you know, in the public eye or the public mind. And it's also important, I think, to remember that there has been a hugely funded, concerted effort to see to it that he would not be confirmed as a justice, nor would anybody on President Trump's short list. And this is, you know, it goes to the process. And I think, you know, we could talk about Brett Kavanaugh, we could talk about the allegations, we could talk about the evidence. But I think, again, it's really important to remember, Peter, where is the opposition coming from and what is really at stake with it? And it all comes down to votes. People understand that because he was the majority leader, Mitch McConnell was able to delay a vote on Merrick Garland when President Obama was in power. This is how our process works. If you don't have the votes, you don't get your guy. And it's one of the perks of being president that you get to nominate Supreme Court justices. It's also one of the perks of being a majority leader that you get to navigate that process. You get to steer that process. And so those in the opposition are coming up with different tactics to try to obstruct or influence that process. And it's all of a piece in my mind. Now, if someone was sexually assaulted, of course, that's extremely upsetting, and that is criminal, and we need to bring the force of law, if necessary, against those who would perpetrate sexual assaults. That's not in question, and I don't think any reasonable person on either side of the aisle would argue that. But I think that we're talking about something that's gone so far beyond that, that it's just that we have to really keep it in context.
Well, and certainly as part of that reality of the confirmation process is the Roe versus Wade. And regardless of how this goes down, it's not going to bring an end to that dialogue and that sort of difficult, charged moment in our country. And next week, it looks like there's going to be a movie release that undoubtedly will gain some more steam in terms of adding fuel to the fire a bit. And it's titled Gosnell, The Trial of America's Biggest Serial Killer. It's being released on the 12th of October, and it talks about the life of Kermit Gosnell, an abortion doctor out of Philadelphia. Have you seen much of this, Kim?
I read the book, and I also interviewed the people who made the movie several times as they were working on that project. But I'm really looking forward to seeing the movie. I haven't seen it yet. Been reading the reviews, though, and I think it's fascinating that they chose to cast this as a true crime story about a serial killer rather than having it be about abortion or politics or any of the other ways that they could have told that story. And when you start looking at it as a true crime story,
it really exposes what abortion is and what it does to everybody who's involved in it.
And I know for you, Kim, in terms of just your own journey and your own experience that you've talked about, and I was with some people recently, and she was sharing her experience having been a person who really, you know, had bought into some of the normal cultural ways of thinking about these things, that she got pregnant at an early age and had an abortion and didn't really think much about it at the time. But it's led to sort of an ongoing trauma in her life that she did then ultimately find forgiveness and hope and restoration. And so, Kim, I would love for you to speak with our listeners about that. Certainly many people have had their lives touched by abortion, and it does sometimes feel like this unforgivable sin. And yet it's really not as troubling as it is. There is still hope and future.
Yeah, well, and I think it's really important to remember, as you say, you know, I've talked with so many women who have said, I didn't even remember that I had an abortion until I heard you start talking about it, because it is treated as something like akin to a tooth extraction, you know, that there's no moral proposition involved because we as a culture have decided to depersonalize unborn children before their birth. And so what can happen, I think, in the aftermath, Peter, is two things generally. You are either heartbroken or your heart has been hardened to the fact that a life was even lost. And so there are two very different things that have to happen, right? I mean, if you're heartbroken, you need restoration. You need to know about the forgiveness that Christ won for us with the blood he shed at the cross. You need to know that, you know, there are people who will understand and welcome you and help you to grasp that forgiveness in all the fullness of its, you know, restoring power and to heal us and to make us new and to help the guilt and the grief to recede finally in our lives. In my case, that took over 20 years for that process to be completed. But if you are listening and you've had an abortion and you're saying, well, I just don't see it that way. I don't believe that it was a life. I don't believe that I did anything wrong. It helped me keep my life on track. In that case, I would really appeal to you to stop and think about your premise. You know, how do you know that the child whose life was lost in an abortion was not a human being with an equal value to your life? It's our human nature that endows us with our value, Peter, of course, and that doesn't come to us in degrees. And nor can it be diminished by anything that we do or don't do or anything that happens to us. It's our birthright as human beings. And not only that, it's there from the very beginning. You didn't come from an embryo, as we say, making the case for life. You once were an embryo. And there's no morally significant difference between the embryo you once were and the adult that you are now that could justify killing you then but not now. And it takes some time to be persuaded of these things, because our culture says something so very different. I mean, even the people who handled the Gosnell case, pretty much everybody who, you know, knew about what Gosnell was doing, looked the other way, said that it wasn't killing, said that it wasn't improper, said that, you know, the Supreme Court ruling that gave women a right to abortion somehow made it right. But it can never be justified morally. And so, you know, if you've been personally impacted by abortion, know that if your heart is breaking, that Jesus Christ's love is sufficient and his forgiveness includes you. And if you're not yet persuaded of it, I would ask you to think through what your opinion is really based on, and to think about setting aside the self-justification in favor of having compassion on the unborn that you would also extend to yourself or to others whose lives are impacted by an unintended pregnancy.
Such important words of hope and encouragement for people that have been touched by the difficulties of abortion. Kim, when we come back, I'm going to ask you about some headlines that were coming out of the FDA that they recently ended contracts for trading fetal tissue. So maybe there's some hope moving forward in this process that some of these really troubling practices will end in our country. So more with Kim Cotola of Cradle Our Heart Ministries next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm joined on the line by Kim Cotola of Cradle My Heart Ministries. And Kim, you're going to be up in the Fargo-Moorhead area, it sounds like, tomorrow, doing a banquet that is called Lutherans for Life. Tell us about that.
Well, and yes, I'm excited about that. We're going to talk about I'm really trying to engage people who have not been personally impacted by abortion, Peter. You know, the bystanders are always the margin of victory in any great conflict. Hmm. The bystanders can shut down the bullies at a school, right?
Yep.
The bystanders were the people who rescued Jews in the Holocaust during World War II. And it doesn't, you know, social science, we're going to get into this in my talk tomorrow night. Social science says that people who move from being bystanders to rescuers don't necessarily have any great connection to the victims. In fact, often, you know, the victims are marginalized or people who are not admired, which is how they become victims. But people who are rescuers are those who have empathy, who have compassion, and who have a high sense of social responsibility. And aren't those characteristics that should define us as followers of Jesus Christ, right? And so in this great war on children that characterizes our culture and our day, you know, what are the actions that we can take to become rescuers? It doesn't mean that you're going to have to stand outside an abortion facility with a sign, although that might be part of it. That might be what God calls you to do. But there are ways that each and every one of us can impact the culture positively and become part of the answer and part of the solution to end abortion in our time. Because, you know, Peter, all of the things that are happening on a legislative level and this battle over the Supreme Court, so many of these things are aimed at drying up the supply of abortion, right? Limiting access and making it illegal and so on. But we as Christians have the opportunity every single day to work on the demand, right? If we can impress our sons and daughters about the importance of marriage and the importance of chastity and purity before marriage and, you know, keeping pure within marriage, and some of these other things that reflect our Christian worldview, if we can really live that out and help others and support others to be making those healthy choices, the demand for abortion will dramatically decrease. And we've seen that time and again. And so we're going to talk about rescue. We're going to talk about, you know, impacting the culture right where you are, shining the light right where you are to really make a difference. That's a great conflict of our time.
Yeah, it's such an important encouragement. I mean, I understand love in the biblical text to be this other-centered desire for the wholeness of another. And so we give of ourselves on behalf of the wholeness of the other. And to your point, Kim, for those of us maybe that haven't been touched specifically like by abortion, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be interested in the wholeness around us and we can get involved.
Right. And again, science of embryology, Peter, teaches us that these are indeed human beings, that from conception forward, the zygote is a distinct, living, whole human being. Over 20 embryology textbooks agree to this. And so what is our duty to these youngest members of the human family? You know, every day, thousands of them are being killed in our country. Almost a million every year. And what people don't know, maybe, you know, we sort of skipped right over, I did in my answer about Gosnell. He was found guilty of felony murder in doing late-term abortions of children who could have lived and, in fact, were alive. They survived his botched techniques, and then he would snip their necks with scissors to bring about their deaths. He also killed one of his patients through improperly administering anesthesia. Kayamana Mungar was the woman's name, and he was found guilty of that second-degree manslaughter. He's serving several life sentences for these crimes because it's killing. And if we know that this is happening in our communities, in our state, in our nation, what would God have us do about that? And you're right, it's an other-centered worldview that says, this is my responsibility. I do have the empathy for these young ones and for the women who are being exploited by this billion-dollar industry, you know, to stand up and say, enough is enough. We want something better.
And Kim, I think that is such the important invitation. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I would recommend our listeners to go to your website and see that you'll be, if you're in the Fargo-Moorhead area tomorrow, to go to Triumph Lutheran Church and join Kim. So we got to wrap up or take a break and wrap up our show here for the morning on Faith Radio Mornings. Well, as always, great to be with you as listeners around our listening audience as we talk about the news and the special topics, even like this last one with Kim Cotola, from a perspective of hope and genuine faith. So look forward to catching you tomorrow again, bright and early on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.